Good morning, and welcome to Great Loop Radio, brought to you every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time by America's Great Loop Cruisers Association. AGLCA and our Admiral sponsors, Barber Marina, Curtis Stokes & Associates, Dog River Marina, Dozier's Regatta Point Yachting Center, Dozier's Waterway Guides and Magazines, Richardson's Map Tech, Passage Maker Troller Fest, and Skipper Bob Publications invite you to join us as we explore the Great Loop every Friday morning with a show chock full of information that's useful to you whether you are dreaming of, in the midst of, or planning a trip around the Great Loop. And don't forget to visit our store at www.greatloop.org/store. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another week of AGLCA Radio. We have our usual home port crew, which is me, Steve, and then Beth and Janice and Roger are all on here. They can say hello real quick if they want to.
Hi.
Hello. Good morning.
And our guest host today is Captain Henry Marks, who owns Landfall Navigation and is a sponsor of AGLCA. Henry always goes above and beyond at our rendezvous. So in the spring rendezvous, he's doing blow up a life raft and launch it and let people get in it and out of it and all that sort of stuff. Is that correct, Henry?
That's correct.
So that's a lot of fun if you go into the rendezvous in the spring.
Also, if the weather's warm enough and the pool's warm enough, we have an in-the-water life jacket demonstration, which anybody's welcome to participate in.
What? I was even wondering, Henry, the way that's laid out, you might be able to do it in the marina because it's enclosed. You can look at that when you get there.
Yeah, well, how far north alligators come?
I don't think there's any alligators in there. But anyway, Henry's going to talk today about the Coast Guard requirements of what safety equipment you have to have on a boat. So as we go along here, if anybody has questions, feel free to call us on our toll-free number, which is 877-497-1815.
Registered. If you're state registered, you have to check your individual state requirements. For the federal registration, you're a documented vessel. You have to have your name on the vessel, either on both sides of the bow and on the stern, and a hailing port, which is normally either your residence city or used to be the Coast Guard Documentation Center. You also need a ship station radio license for the vessel if you're leaving U.S. waters. If you stay in U.S. waters, you technically do not need the ship station radio license. You also need individually a restricted radio telephone operator permit, and again, if you leave U.S. waters, and I gather from the recent blog activity that the Canadians are enforcing this. So be sure you have your radio licenses, and that's an FCC issue, whereas documentation is a Coast Guard issue, and state registration is your home port, your home state. Remember, however, if you're going to travel internationally, that state registration does not get the respect that U.S. Coast Guard documentation does. With a U.S. Coast Guard documentation, you are a U.S. flag vessel, and as such, is entitled to certain protections under international law. Steve?
I was going to ask you about the documentation. There is a... You have to be above a certain size vessel in order to get Coast Guard documentation?
Most vessels under 30 or 35 feet don't document. But once you get over 35 feet, I've got a 41-foot sloop, and she's been documented, I know. And most boats my size and up are documented.
Okay. You want to talk about PFDs for a little bit?
Can I interject for 1 minute?
Yeah.
Sure.
At the radio licenses, I spoke with a representative from Canada yesterday, and there's a phone number that you can call to get information from Canada about that radio requirement, and it's 613-943-2502.
Okay, good.
Okay. PFDs, well, these are a little bit like the American Express card. Never leave home without it. The statistics speak for themselves. People that fall overboard frequently drown. I have a friend who says that the a pocket full of tennis balls is better than nothing, but you really need a life jacket. Now, having spent a little time on powerboats and trawlers, wearing a bulky life jacket in the pilot house is really inconvenient at best, and I like the inflatable life vests. However, common sense has to come in here. If you're in the pilot house and you've got high bulwarks and nobody's going near the edge, you don't have to wear it all the time, but if you're going to be docking, where people might be leaning over the side, fueling, or you're standing on the swim platform, slipping on a life jacket isn't a bad thing. As a matter of fact, I know on the East Coast, in the locks, if you get off the vessel, you have to be wearing a life jacket in the locks. That's a federal requirement. As I say, the inflatable life vests are the way to go. They are very comfortable. They're Coast Guard approved. They will give you 35 pounds of flotation. If I could take 30 seconds, life jackets are rated by types. A Type 1 SOLAS, standing for Safety of Life at Sea, has 35 pounds of buoyancy in it, which will turn an unconscious person face up in the water every time. There's a Coast Guard Type 1, which is only 22 pounds of flotation, but this will also turn a person face up in the water every time. Then we get to the Type 2s, which is what most of us have in those life preserver bags under a seat somewhere. They're little horse collars. They only have 15 pounds of flotation, and they may turn an unconscious person face up in the water. It's not guaranteed. Then we get to the Type 3s, which is what we all wore in junior sailing or junior boating activities, and many of you probably still wear in a dinghy. And they have 13 pounds of flotation. And I gave a demonstration a couple of years ago at the Loopers, and if the weather's okay, I'm going to try and do it again in Norfolk, where I'll get in a pool with a Type 3 life jacket on, lay on my back, and relax as if I were unconscious, and I will gradually turn over face down in the water. Yes, the Marine Police will get your body back, but that's what they'll get back. They won't get you back if you're unconscious. So I recommend the inflatable vests, which are comfortable and very unobtrusive. However, one caveat, the inflatable life vests are not legal for anybody under 16 years of age or 90 pounds. Steve?
Yeah, one of the things that Janice and I do on the boat is we put on an inflatable life jacket before we start the engines in the morning and don't take them off until we shut the engines down. It's like putting on a seatbelt in a car to us. It's, you know, inside, outside doesn't matter. We just put them on. The other question I had.
My last trip back from Bermuda, I never took it off for 3 days. I included sleeping in it, but then we had 50 knots winds, 10 to 12 foot seas, and conditions that you loopers will hopefully never see.
Yeah. Talk about the differences in the recommendation between an automatic inflatable and a manual inflatable.
If you're in a pilot house or in a light aircraft, a manual inflatable is probably a better idea. Because if you were to be rolled over on your side and the pilot house filled with water, the automatic inflatable would inflate. And whether or not you can get out the cabin door with the life jacket inflated, I'm not sure. Remember, on the aircraft, they tell you don't inflate it until you get out of the aircraft. However, if you're on the foredeck of a sailboat or you're outdoors, the automatic is better because if you fall overboard and you're stunned, the jacket will inflate automatically and you'll wake up looking at the stars or the sun and be okay. Whereas if you're unconscious, your manual jacket's not going to help you much. I wear an automatic, but then I'm primarily a sailboat driver.
I had a question here and just lost it, so I guess we're going to go on to something else.
Okay.
Oh, I know what it was. If it's a rainy day, will the rain set off an automatic inflatable?
Not if it's properly cared for.
Okay.
Inflatable PFDs do require maintenance. Once a year, you have to... you should orally inflate them. There's a tube. You can blow them up, leave them set overnight to make sure they hold air. If they don't hold air, they won't hold you. It's time to do something. But if you have an automatic unit, the old style with the bobbins, little yellow discs, you need to change that disc every year, and you need to just verify that the CO2 cartridge is armed. The new Coast Guard approved units all have a red and green button in them, and you can see at a glance whether it's red or green, hence good to go or not.
What about something like a float coat?
Well, I wear a float coat in the wintertime because I've got to wear a parka anyway to stay warm up here in Connecticut. I might as well wear one that's going to make me float rather than one that isn't. There's a lot of variations of float coats. You're familiar with the Mustang float coats, of course, and there's an outfit called Stormy Seas that makes a jacket somewhat like a Chuck Rose jacket, which has a bladder in it that you can pull a handle on. And the Floatec line of windbreakers is really nice because it has a bladder in it. And on the Floatec, you can unzip the sleeves and make it into a vest if you want to. They're very popular with fishermen.
Okay, good. Anything else on PFDs? What we didn't talk about.
A couple of things. Remember that if you're riding on a personal watercraft or towed behind the boat tubing, Connecticut state law and U.S. Coast Guard law says you have to be wearing a life jacket. And if you're water skiing, and I presume tubing is the same, they have to be speed rated. So check your PWC dealer as to what the rules are on that. Up here in the Northland, they've come out with a new regulation that manually propelled, which means small boats under, I think, 16 feet. Between the 1st of October and the 1st of June, you have to be wearing a life jacket in the boat because they've had so many cold water drownings. Janice?
I was just curious. Did you say speed-related? Speed-required?
Speed-rated.
Really? I would never have expected that.
Well, if you fall off water skis at 35 knots, your impact on the water is going to be very different than if you roll a sailing dinghy over. And in a recent disaster in Australia, woman had on an inflatable life vest and was tethered to the boat, and when they found her body, she had no vest and no tether. So nobody really knows what happened. High impact does bad things.
What about throwables?
Every vessel over 16 feet is required to have a Type 4 throwable device. Now, the Type 4 throwable device normally is either the yellow horseshoe or white horseshoe or the traditional life ring. However, those Coast Guard-approved Type 4 seat cushions that we used to be able to use in the dinghy as a life preserver for rowing ashore, they are also legally a Type 4. However, remember, the Type 4 has to be somewhere convenient to the helm so that if somebody falls overboard, you can throw it to them. Because once they leave the boat, you've got to get flotation to them as quickly because 30 seconds or a minute and they're out of reach. Okay?
One of the things that we did, we use a traditional life ring and tied a 50-foot polypropylene line on it so that there's something trailing behind it if I have to throw it overboard.
If that line is tied to the boat, you just decertified that life ring.
It's not tied to the boat.
That life ring is not supposed to have anything attached to the boat on it.
It's not
there's also a device called a life sling, which is Coast Guard approved now, and that's a device. That's a horseshoe that is tied to the boat. You throw it over the stern, and you make a circle around the victim in the water, like you were picking up a water skier. When the victim gets to the ring, stop the boat, let them get snapped into it, and then, leaving the boat stop, reel them in and bring them aboard. Be careful, however, if you have people in a life sling, if you start towing them through the water. We found out in tests in San Francisco Bay that 2.5 knots in a life sling and you become and it becomes an otter board and it drags you down. But the problem with a life sling is it's a recovery device, it's not a life-saving device. When I fall overboard, the life sling does me no good until you've had time to stop the boat, throw over the life sling, make a circle around me and get the life sling to me. All that time I have to stay afloat on my own. Steve?
Yeah, good. Let's talk about flares.
A landfall only sells the SOLAS grade, again, Safety of Life at Sea Convention flares. These are the, in the case of parachutes, the more expensive ones. The difference between a SOLAS flare and an Olin flare, or I guess they're not Olin anymore, is that the parachute flare is 40,000 candle power for 30,000 candle power for 40 seconds. The 25 millimeter flare is, I believe, 20,000 candle power for 25 seconds. It's quite a difference. If you've ever seen a flare demonstration, nobody's ever had to tell you which handheld flare was a Solis flare. They are much brighter. They last longer. And in the end, they are no more expensive than the other flares. However, the bad news with flare kits is that every 3 years you have to buy a new flare kit because the Coast Guard has an expiration date on them of 3 years. When you buy flares, be very careful when you pick them off the shelf in your local chandlery. Look at the expiration date on the flares because we work very hard here. We turn our flares over about every 6 weeks. And then, hence, we have a smaller inventory on hand than you would think. Because when you buy flare from me, you want to be sure that you're going to get a full 3 years' worth of usage out of it. You don't want a flare that's already a year old and a third of the way through its lifespan. So check the dates on flares before you buy them. Steve?
Yeah, I had that where I went looking for flares in West Marine one time, and the flare had less than 2 years left on it, so it was go buy it someplace else at that point. How many flares do you need to have on board?
Well, the Coast Guard rule says 2 day-night signals, which would be 2 handheld red flares. Technically, you've met the Coast Guard requirement. However, again, it's a function of your voyage. If you're going around the world, we'd recommend something like our Trans-Ocean kit, which has about a dozen parachutes and a dozen red handhelds in it, as well as some orange smoke canisters and a dye marker. The kit I carry on my boat, which is Coastal Sailing, which I think would be good for the loopers, is it's a plastic 50-caliber ammunition box and has 2 Solis parachute flares, 2 red handheld flares, and 2 handheld orange smokes. Now, everybody says you light smoke and it blows away in the wind. Well, that's true, almost. What happens with the smoke is it blows away in the wind so you can't see it looking horizontally from the boat out across the water. But if you're in a helicopter looking down, that orange smoke lays down on the water and it forms an arrow into the wind back to you in the water or where you are. Steve?
Okay. Fire extinguishers. What's the requirement?
Fire extinguishers, yes. Here's another neglected area. The Coast Guard is very clear about fire extinguishers. Let me find my cheat sheet here. If your vessel's under 26 feet, you need 1 B1 fire extinguisher. If you're 26 to 40 feet, you need 1 B2 or 2 B1s. And these have to do with size and weight. I believe a B1 is a 2.5-3 pound, and a B2 is a 5. And to give you an idea, the other thing confusing about fire extinguishers is they talk about Class A fires, Class B fires, Class C fires, and so on. Class A fire is wood, paper, etc. Water puts it out, dry chemical puts it out, halotron puts it out. B, gasoline. Water on a gasoline fire, especially under pressure, just spreads the fire around. Halotron, CO2 works well on that. Class C is electrical. Electrical fires, halotron is your best bet because it doesn't damage the electrical equipment. It puts the fire out. The negative to the halotron, and hopefully you all have a halotron system in your engine rooms, is that if you're in a compartment with halotron, it's not going to work out well because it's lethal. It sucks all the oxygen out of the air and you'll suffocate. So if you use a halotron and fire extinguisher, get out of the compartment after you've set it off. D is something that we don't normally run into, which is combustible metals. You may remember that the British in the Falklands War had a destroyer hit by an Exocet missile, and she burst into flames while she was magnesium. And when you get magnesium burning, it's very light and a handy metal, but boy, when you get it on fire, you got trouble. And so when you look to buy a fire extinguisher, think about what kind of fire you're going to put out, and it tells you on the label what it's going to be. Now, the other thing about fire extinguishers nobody does is you should have them checked once a year. We have a plan here at Landfall where, as a commercial building, we have to have the fire extinguishers inspected annually. Well, when they're inspected annually, everybody gets to bring their fire extinguishers from home with their boats in, and we have them tagged too because they should be checked once a year to be sure that they're still current. I'm a big fan of Halotron because I did put a galley fire out once with the dry powder stuff. And 2 years later, when I changed the carpets, we still had dry powder in the carpets. We were vacuuming it. We never got rid of it.
Yeah.
Hey, Henry, where would you get these fire extinguishers checked out? I mean, do I have to take them to the fire department?
Well, I have yet to find a fire department that did not have a fireman who had a fire extinguisher business on the side. Hey, however, there are companies, I know we have two here in the Stamford, Connecticut area, that are in the phone book under fire extinguisher service, and they'll send a man out with a truck and a scale and all sorts of stuff. And for example, on CO2 and Halotron, every 6 years, the cylinder has to be pressure tested. So when you get to the 6 year, you have a decision to make whether it's cheaper to buy a new extinguisher or have this one emptied, pressure tested, and refilled. But you really need to maintain. This is another thing that never gets maintained until you need it. Another thing that goes along with fire extinguishers that I have on the boat, I can't get my wife to hang one in the kitchen, is a fire blanket. This is a red piece of material that is fireproof that's about the size of a baby blanket. And it's in a little red box and hangs on the bulkhead, and you just pull a tab on the bottom of it. If you get a galley fire, you yank that thing out, throw it over the stove, and the fire's out. Do not, as I saw a video of, pour water on it like a woman did and was severely.
Still there?
Okay.
One of the comments that I have on our boat, I don't think we're ever more than two or three steps from a fire extinguisher. We have them in all the sleeping cabins. We've got them in the galley. We've got them in every place. And it just, you know, if a fire goes out, running downstairs to get the fire extinguisher is not a particularly good thing to do.
Well, I
have them, Steve?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do we test them every year?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Well, I have a sailboat, and I have one in each berth. I have a 3-pound unit in each berthing compartment, which is basically there just to, if you smoke in bed, which you shouldn't, and you catch fire, you can either get the fire out or it'll get you out of the compartment. I have one across from the engine room door, as well as a Halotron system in the engine room. And then I have a big 10-pound CO2 one at the bottom of the companionway, which you can reach. You can actually lean in from the cockpit and grab it. And that's my sort of general purpose fire extinguisher, because it's real handy from the helm. It's handy from almost anywhere. It's in the central part of the boat, and it's there. And for those of you that are ex-service people, you probably remember we used to use the CO2 to cool the beer.
Yeah, I was just sitting here counting. I think I have 10 fire extinguishers on board.
You're probably overdone, but that's something we're over, well, better under.
Yeah, if you're going to go wrong, you might as well be over on it. Let's talk about running lights and horns and whistles and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, most boats, you get the running lights of manufacturer put on the boat, and they do meet the Coast Guard requirements. Where people get into trouble with running lights is it's in vogue now to put your inflatable on the stern and then pull it up on its side across the stern. Very handy place on the swim platform to store your inflatable. The only trouble is the inflatable is probably over the stern light, which means that tug and barge that's coming down behind you in the middle of the night doesn't know you're there. Not a good plan. Another place you get into trouble is bimini tops sometimes obscure the steaming light, which, again, when somebody's coming at you, will confuse them. So just make sure, A, that your running lights work. Every time I'm running at night, it's a half hour before sunset, we turn the running lights on. I go around and check each running light physically to make sure they're working, and I log it. I'm running as a professional delivery skipper here, not recreation. So whether you log it or not, it's unimportant. But when you turn them on, make sure they're working. And carry spare bulbs.
Yeah. The what about horns? And
again, you're required to have a horn. I think it's over 16 feet. But vessels less than 39 feet have some means of making an efficient sound signal. Over 39 feet, they must have a fixed horn. And I believe if you're over 100 feet, you have to have a gong on the stern and a horn on the bow. But you need a horn. One simple solution is these most of these loud hailing systems also have horn systems in them. And the nice thing about that is if you get into the fog, and those of you coming to New England, you're going to be in the fog, you can set that thing up and it blows every 2 minutes whether you remember or not. When I was a kid and we all had mouth-blown foghorns is all we had, we'd be sailing across Block Island Sound and visibility was maybe 200 or 300 feet, and nobody would be blowing a foghorn. I asked my dad about it, and he said, well, when we hear the other vessel blow, then we'll blow a whistle horn and tell them we're here. Well, that went through.
Yeah, that's a good idea, especially if the other guy's on the same plan.
Yeah, and of course, if you're anchored, you're over, I believe, 39 feet, you have to have a bell, because if you're anchored in the fog, you're supposed to ring the bell every 2 minutes, I believe it is.
Okay.
Again, a book that everybody should have are the what we call the coal regs, or CG-169. It's a white book published by the Department of Homeland Security, United States Coast Guard, and it's all of the navigation regulations. It covers everything from proper lookout, safe speed, risk of collision, action to avoid collision, narrow channels, which you're going to run into in the Western rivers, and then traffic separation schemes, which is something when you get to places like New York Harbor and you enter Chesapeake Bay will be a real eye-opener to you. And sailing vessels, overtaking vessels, head-on situations has all the rules. And then in the back it shows all of the lights, sound and light signals. And it's a $14 book. It's not going to break your budget. And I keep one on the bridge anytime I'm operating a vessel, because for those of you who have seen a dredge working, either a day or at night, and at night they're even more confusing. It's a mass of funny-looking shapes and funny-looking lights, and if you look in this book, it explains the whole thing to you very clearly in a picture.
Well, anything over 12 meters is required to have it on board, isn't that true?
Yeah, that's 39 feet.
Yeah, 39.
Technically, feet. If you have a copy of Chapman's on the vessel, you have a coal race, but I've never gone that route.
Yeah, me neither.
Hey, Henry, I got one for you.
Okay.
The green and red lights that are on your bow, I live on a sailboat as well, and I have them on the top of my mast, but I do not have them on my bow. Is that a problem?
No, you have a tricolor. You have a three-way light up there. You have
right.
Or it's red, green, and white, and it shows in the three quadrants with your stern. Stern light, I believe, is 120 degrees, and the light on your masthead is 120 degrees. In the open ocean, a tricolor is much more effective, because in the open ocean, you're going to see the sailboat from a distance first, and that tricolor light's going to be above the sea clutter. The problem is when you're operating in like the Western rivers, that tricolor may be lost in the trees.
Right.
Well, if you've got your mast unstepped to get it down some of those rivers, then it's not going to be anywhere.
Well, that's the other problem you got. When you take the mast down, what are you doing for running lights?
Just the comment that I have at this point is, if you go to any power squadron in the country or any Coast Guard auxiliary unit in the country and ask for a courtesy inspection, they will send somebody to your boat and go through the boat to make sure you have all of the required equipment on board and whatever it is that you're supposed to have. They will make sure it's there, and if you pass the inspection, you get a sticker that you put on the boat, and sometimes that'll help with you not getting boarded. Can't guarantee that, but they look for it when they're coming to do a boarding. They'll look on the side of the boat, and sometimes it'll just help you out.
The work before the Homeland Security boys got in the act.
Yeah. Anyway, we're perfectly on time here, so thank you very much, Henry. We did a good job this week.
Okay, well, enjoyed it. I hope I see everybody in Norfolk in about 3 weeks.
Cool. You want to talk about what's on next week's show? Who's doing that?
I think Beth was going to address that.
Okay, next week we have Vanessa Barassa of the Canada Border Services Agency. And she's going to talk about cruising around Canada and the regulations, but we will not be having live calling questions next week. So if you do have a question for her, please email it to Janice at jcromer@greatloop.org. And that's
great.
That.
I know I do this every week, but for those of you that aren't able to listen live, all of our shows are archived on the website. So if you go to www.greatloop.org, on the left-hand side, there's a tab for AGLCA Radio. You click on that, and you can listen to any of them. And I think that's it for today. Right on time. Unusual.
Hey. Perfect. Thank you.
See you all.
See you all.
Bye-bye.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone.